Welcome to the Open House podcast site, available at openhouseonline.com.au.
Well, on October 12, 1999, the United Nations celebrated the Day of 6 Billion. That was the official date when the world's population was estimated to have reached the 6 billion mark, and we've, of course, been throwing that figure around ever since as the population of the Earth. Well, believe it or not, August 26, 2011 has been tagged the Day of 7 Billion, and that's not the only exciting development you can expect this year. According to futurist Richard Watson, there's plenty more in store. He's on the line now, and a happy 2011 to you, Richard Watson.
And happy 2011 to you too. Bit late, but still true.
Indeed, exactly. So, 7 billion, that's been pretty rapid growth, hasn't it? A billion people in 12 years. Why are we growing so fast?
Well, it's pretty interesting. I mean, demographics sounds like such a sort of dry and boring subject, and it's actually pretty fascinating if you sort of look at it in the right way. I mean, from about 1900 to 2000, it actually quadrupled. It went from about 1.6 billion to 6.1 billion. Now, I think what people tend to assume is that the reason for this is that we were breeding like rabbits. And actually, that's not really quite true. The reason it's sort of growing so fast is that we're not dropping like flies. It's actually sort of a healthcare revolution more than anything else. I mean, in 1900, the global life expectancy was about 30, and by 2000, 11 years ago, it was 65. So, you know, less of us are dying, we're living a lot longer. So one of the features of the future is, you know, old people, quite frankly. I mean, young people are going to be something of a rarity.
Also, the growth isn't evenly spread, is it? We keep on hearing about, you know, greater population growth in, say, developing countries, the Western countries not reproducing enough.
Yeah, I mean, it's, again, you need to sort of dig into this in quite a lot of detail. I mean, yes, a lot of the growth is happening in Asia, and it's almost completely true that most developed nations, particularly sort of the so-called West, have actually got rapidly declining populations. I mean, the other thing we haven't sort of touched on here is you've got declining fertility in most developed nations. I mean, we've got a sort of birth rate that's actually below the sort of optimal rate or below the replacement rate. So we've actually got sort of shrinkage of young people while we've got the sort of the older people sort of hanging around, so to speak. But even if you look at somewhere like China, which everyone assumes is sort of booming population-wise, is they do have a looming demographic problem. They've already got worker shortages, and they are having a sort of a shortage of births if you go out far enough. I mean, they've got a one-child policy. They've had it for quite a long time, and that's causing a lot of problems. The critical measure, if you're a sort of a government or a business, is the working age population, which is sort of roughly about 15 or 16 up to about 65. And that is shrinking alarmingly. And most of the growth that we're going to see over the next 30, 40 years in the working age population is actually coming from sub-Saharan Africa and places like Pakistan and Bangladesh. I think they're responsible for about half of the growth. Japan is in terrible trouble. I mean, they are aging so rapidly and they have such a low birth rate and they're quite anti-immigration. They're facing some particular challenges. The U.S., bizarrely, is almost unique in developed nations in actually expanding its working population over the next 20, 30 years, partly because of the fertility rate and partly because they're quite open to immigration. And I think Australia is not as bad as it could be either.
What are the other practical ramifications, therefore, of what you've just shared? I mean, if we're going to have, like you said, young people are going to be a rarity on the world scheme, what are some of the practical applications or ramifications of this, you know, economically, socially, and the rest?
Well, the two classic ones are sort of rising cost of healthcare and sort of how you pay for super and pensions, which people are trying to sort of struggle with at the moment. So healthcare will take up an increasing percentage of GDP in the future, and that means we can't spend it on something else. So, you know, education may well suffer, particularly if there are less young people wanting to be educated. There could be some interesting development, like sort of generational conflict in offices and so on. I mean, you've got some older people sort of refusing to let go and leave because they need the money to keep living, and you've got younger people who want to sort of start work and move into those occupations and so on. We could potentially see many more generations living together under one house and one roof as well. You know, we've got sort of younger people unable to move out because of the cost of things, and older people moving back in with their parents because of the cost of healthcare and getting old. So you have a sort of three generations sandwiched together in one house, which might be quite interesting.
Indeed. Well, before we all run to the hills, because it sounds like the world is about to end, I mean, are there any positive that's going to...
Well, yeah, I mean, if you go out long enough, we don't have a problem. I mean, you know, everyone worries about the population and strain on ecosystems and resources, and in the short term, that is absolutely true. I mean, that there is a mad scramble for everything from sort of oil and water to lithium and wheat and so on and so forth, meat and fish and everything, but you know, eventually the population falls off a cliff because of the declining fertility, and it starts thinning out again. So I don't think the growing population is anything to worry about particularly. I think the planet is able to sustain 7 billion quite easily.
Mm. Open House is what you're listening to. Futurist Richard Watson from Now and Next is on the line. We're talking about some of the things you can look forward to or indeed expect in 2011 by the end of the year. Let's bunch a couple of these other ones together. You're kind of forecasting for the year ahead. Uncertainty, volatility, discontentment, basically to start on a negative note. We'll get to something a little bit more cheery in just a second. Why are you saying that there's going to be an increase in those three, you know, rather negative words?
Well, they are a little bit negative, I'm afraid. Number of reasons. The uncertainty, I think, at the moment is predominantly economic. Now, you happen to be sitting in a very fortunate country, the lucky country in more ways than one. You know, you've got an economy that's booming off the back of China due to large holes in the ground and so forth. I'm currently sitting in the UK and things aren't looking quite so rosy. But, you know, even in Australia, I think you're quite vulnerable. I mean, if the US were to fall over economically, it could take China with it because China's so export-orientated. China could fall over for its own reasons. So there's a lot of fragility in the global economy. So people can't really see very far down the road. And I think that's making people sort of slightly nervous. The volatility is also coming from a sort of universal connectivity that we have these days. Everything is increasingly connected to everything else. So it's a bit of a giant pack of cards. And if one little bit falls over, it has a tendency, I think, to take the entire thing with it. So that's making people quite nervous. There's also the acceleration of change in technology. People, particularly older people, can barely keep up with all the new stuff that's changing and being launched and so on and so forth. So that's making people feel a little bit uneasy. And then we have, you know, lovely little things like terrorism that sort of keep us on our toes. We're kind of waiting for the next thing to happen the entire time. Mm. And also, you know, if you're dealing with a global system that's increasingly complex, it's relatively easy to disrupt complex systems. And it could be accidental failure or it could be deliberate attack. And if, I say, one little bit sort of falls over, it causes chaos. It's a bit like if you imagine the traffic in a very, very busy city and there's a crash or somebody breaks down on one of the roads, you have all the surrounding roads suddenly start jamming up because of that simple event.
And discontentment?
In terms of discontent, again, it depends on which part of the world you're talking about. I think in most of Asia, people are fairly optimistic about the future, particularly in places like sort of China and India. You've got rising incomes. You know, material expectations are increasing, and everyone's actually, I think, relatively happy. If you look at the US and Northwestern Europe in particular, you are facing a situation where people are sort of looking ahead and thinking, you know, I'm going to have to live with less. I'm going to have to expect less. I am not going to be able to live as well materially as my parents. I'm not going to live in a house that's as nice in an area that's as nice. I'm not going to be able to afford the same kind of education. I might not have as good a job. My real wages are likely to decline. So, you know, particularly in the sort of what they call the squeezed middle, the cost of everything is going up, energy, food, and so on. Taxes are going up, yet the infrastructure that we all expect from our taxes, like education, transport, police, and so on, seems to be crumbling around our feet. So this is making people, you know, somewhat nervous and actually somewhat angry at the edges as well.
Mm-hmm. Okay, I'll lump these next two together, even though they're not related, but I guess they're related by the word rising. You think that there's going to be a rise in religion and a rise in formality?
Yeah, I mean, religion is an interesting one. I think a lot of people assume it's going to sort of die out because of technology and globalization. And I think almost the opposite is the case. I think globalization is sort of spreading religion very rapidly. But I think the key thing about religion for a lot of people is if you go back to this sort of uncertainty and volatility and discontent, and people are quite sort of anxious about what's ahead, the one thing that organized religions seem to offer people is some level of certainty about why things are as they are and certainly what happens in the end. I mean, it's a pretty clear view of what's in the future if you're a member of an organized religion, and I think that's deeply appealing to people. I also think the sort of individual spiritualism is also increasing for a bunch of slightly separate reasons.
Well, that could also be connected to...
One, again, it depends on which region or which country you're talking about, and I don't think formality is going to be particularly large in the Australian context, which is probably a good thing, but in a lot of other countries, particularly Europe, if you are sort of worried about your future and keeping your job, I think one of the things you do is probably have your hair cut and smarten up a bit clothes-wise so that you're not the one in the firing line. And there's things like the hemline index, which suggests that when the economy is booming, the skirt length go up, and when things are bad, the skirt lengths go down. And, the similar things happen with the length of hair. So I think we should expect in the West, or the US, Northwest Europe, a lot more formality in the future.
Huh. Okay, pajamas.
Yeah, this is a good one. What have pajamas got to do with rapid technological acceleration, economic uncertainty? Well, actually, quite a lot. I think they offer sort of physical and emotional warmth in cold and complex times, basically. Now, again, I think they work better in the US and northwestern Europe, where it's a bit chilly. I'm not sure they work quite so well in far north Queensland. But it's not all about sort of physical temperature, about sort of emotional comfort and so on. The other sort of critical thing about pajamas, and I suppose in the Australian context, this, you know, pair of boardies or something, we're not necessarily going to go to work anymore. A lot more of us are working from home, and we can sit there naked if we want to. We don't have to put clothes on to go to work. So maybe we have the pajamas on or a pair of boardies, we sleep in them, we get up in them, and we spend the entire day in them without ever changing. So I think we will see a lot more pajamas in the future.
There you go. There's the hot tip on stocks, folks. Buy into the pajama manufacturers. Okay, Richard, will I catch up with you in a fortnight?
Thank you very much indeed, Sheridan. Cheers.
Thanks, Richard. Richard Watson, futurist from nowandnext.com.
We hope you enjoyed this Open House podcast. Thanks to Christian Super and Real World Technology. To hear more from Open House, visit openhouseonline.com.au.